You know, my daughter can come and hear this.
Your daughter can have it anytime she wants. Yeah. That's for sure. Okay. This is Sarah Milligan with the Kentucky Oral History Commission. I'm here with Margaret Plattner, who's the Deputy Commissioner of the Kentucky Department of Veterans Affairs. Today is October 8th, 2009. We're at the Thomas D. Clark Center for Kentucky History, and we are talking about Deputy Commissioner's career as a U.S. Navy in the U.S. Navy Reserves, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just start, a little bit farther back. Just tell me a little bit of background information about yourself, where you're from, where'd you grow up, all that sort of stuff.
Okay. I have a very diverse childhood. I was born in Louisville, Kentucky. Spent my first 4 years living in Lexington, and then we moved to Florida for 8 years. My father managed thoroughbred racetracks. So we spent the majority of the time in Florida, and I loved it because we lived at the beach, and that was a lot of fun. I have very many fond memories of those years. And then when I was a teenager, we moved back full-time to Northern Kentucky, which is where my father is from, and I spent my high school years there. Then went away to college, Denison University, and small liberal arts school in Granville, Ohio. I wanted to go to a small school, and I wanted to get a liberal arts training because I wanted to be well-versed, hopefully, in a lot of different areas. And then my junior year, I come from a non-military background. I did have an uncle that served. He was drafted for Vietnam, but he didn't actually serve in Vietnam. So he served. I take that back. He joined the Guard. He was going to be drafted, and he joined the National Guard. But that's my only exposure to military.
So that's it.
So we moved around a lot as a kid, number one. Number two, I come from a non-military background. So that kind of set the stage for someone who liked adventure. So my junior year in college, this is in the early 1980s, the job market was not good, number one. That was not a big motivator for me to join the Navy. But I wanted to do something that I felt at that time was non-traditional. It's not as non-traditional now for a woman to join the military. And particularly I chose the Navy because I had a love of the ocean, because I grew up next to the ocean in my young years, so that's where that comes from. And I was also at that time pretty ambitious. I grew up in a political family, and I was interested at some point running for political office, and I thought it might be a good idea as a woman to have a military background, so having, you know, being perhaps versed in national security issues. And so politics and, because I had a great interest in politics, I thought the military might be a good way to, add on to, because so much of politics has dealt with the military, and our history has dealt with the military, and I thought that would also be another good reason. So there are a couple of reasons. And I joined, and it was one of the best things I've ever done.
So where did you go to boot camp?
Okay. Actually, I went to Officer Candidate School in Newport, Rhode Island, mm-hmm. which felt like boot camp. I mean, in essence, it was, but we were also taking academic courses that revolved around ships. So, for example, like celestial navigation, naval warfare, piloting, how do you pilot a ship, damage control, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we had boot camp, and all the academics went together, because this is within 16 weeks. You're getting the compressed time that someone does at one of the service academies, that they get 4 years to learn how to be in the military, and at ROTC, which you typically get through your college years if you join ROTC. We're getting all this in 16 weeks. So me not having any background in the military, and pretty much have led a carefree life. I had parents who were very always supportive of me, and were not strict disciplinarians, and so me kind of going from a carefree life to something very, very structured was a big change for me, huge change. And so Officer Candidate School in Newport, Rhode Island was a very tough experience for me, very tough. I mean, I almost didn't make it through, but I did.
What were some of the specific challenges to that?
Well, just the fact that I had a non-military background and pretty much a carefree prior life and carefree thinker, not someone who's very good at, you know, salute and shut up, which is what you do in boot camp, and you do when you're, you know, in the ranks of the military in your early years. When you progress through the ranks, you learn how to work the system a little bit more. You understand the system better. So that was a challenge, just the discipline and the structure, and then being told what to do when you knew something was you thought was stupid, because they tried to play with your mind and do Mickey Mouse things to make you want to quit. So, for example, after dinner one time, I was told, okay, you have to go clean the men's johns. They called them heads. And I had to take a toothbrush and scrub men's urinals to clean. And that was purely just a way of making me, you know, do grunt work to see if I could hack it. Getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and running a couple of miles, you know, in the middle of winter, that's hard to do. You know, having 4 or 5 tests a week and you're in class all day long. Showing up at the mess hall and you have 10 minutes to eat and you have to stand outside in the cold weather and salute and wait until you get permission to eat. Having inspections whereby you work on your uniform for an hour or two and the next day you might have one little speck and you could flunk your inspection. So those are the kind of things that took place that made you think, you know, is this really worth it? But once I've figured out this is just a game, I realized I'm going to play this game because I want to get through it, because I don't think this is totally the real thing. So.
That's pretty smart. So did you finish college before you went in, or you went in as a junior?
Yeah, when you go to officer candidate school, you have to finish college first. So I finished and graduated with a BA in political science. Awesome. And then that fall, after I graduated earlier that June, I went off to Newport, Rhode Island, which is a beautiful place. Beautiful, beautiful place. Naval War College is there. It's OCS was located right on Narragansett Bay. Mm-hmm. Newport, you know, one knows their history. Back in the Gilded Age, had very affluent and very old stately homes, and just a really beautiful area.
How many women were in your class when you went in?
Okay. In my class, there were 5 women out of maybe total of 20. And the men and the women lived on the same floors, and we lived next to each other, but we couldn't have a male roommate. We could only have a female roommate. But we were very much integrated. Everything the men did, we did.
And this was the early 80s.
Yes.
Did you feel like there were any issues? Did you have to do things to prove yourself more?
Yes. I think we had to. There was a saying in the Navy that when a male officer walks into his new command, he's considered strong until proven weak. When a female officer walks into her new command, she's considered weak until proven strong. And I still think that's an issue that women face today. It's not, in some quarters, it's very much the same. I think in other quarters, perhaps that's changed somewhat, because I think there's so many women in the workforce now, and younger people have grown up with women not only as their sisters and their mothers, but also their bosses, their coworkers, fellow students, and fellow athletes, and things of that nature. So, I mean, really, the story of women in the last 30 years is pretty amazing. So I feel like I've been a part of that by being part of a very conservative institution and very male-dominated institution. So
did any of the other 5 women that were in this area, did they drop out, or did they all stick in?
No, they all stuck it out. They were all pretty neat people.
Do you still talk to any of them?
I don't. I wish that I did. And they came from all over the country, from small towns generally. I mean, most people I met were not from, you know, a big metropolitan area. They were from smaller towns. But, you know, some of them seemed, I'm like, I don't know, can they really make it? Because it was more the physical aspect. I thought, can they really cut it? But boy, they stuck it out. I mean, these were women that, you know, they wanted to be there, and they stood up to the test and they got through it.
That says a lot that all of you.
We did. We all got through it.
So what was the next?
And we were all supportive of one another too.
Oh, that's.
Yeah.
I guess that's an important part of that too, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so what was the next step after you got out of
officers? Well, after I got out of officer candidate school, barely, by the, you know, skin of my nose, I suppose, my assignment was in Washington, D.C. at the National Defense University as a special events coordinator. Now, this is a job I did not want, but I wanted to be in Washington. So basically what I did is I served as an aide and I would help put together events and things like that. The National Defense University is a training ground for it's a training ground for all the services working together, the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, the Marine Corps, and they all come together, and these are colonels and captains that are being groomed to become generals or admirals.
Okay.
So I was in a very academic environment, but there were lots of, like, President Nixon came to speak. I remember some Mexican generals came to speak, and so I was responsible for helping to coordinating those events and things of that nature. Now I thought, okay, I didn't go to college to learn to do this, but I knew this was just getting my foot in the door and getting started. So I did, and I met some great people along the way, fantastic people, Congressional Medal of Honor winner, future generals and admirals, and, you know, very, very bright people.
Who are specifically some of those people that stand out in your mind?
Jack Jacobs, who was a Congressional Medal of Honor winner from Vietnam. He and I became good friends. He was there studying at the time. He later got out, and now he's an analyst for MSNBC. So he definitely stuck out in my mind. But, you know, these people were thinkers. These were people like General David Petraeus. They were thinkers, strategists. You know, it wasn't about how macho can I be. It's about I need to be a good thinker. So that was impressive to be around that kind of environment, very bright people. Then after that, because I knew that this was a job that was something I really was not an ultimate goal, but it was a way to be in Washington, and that's where I wanted to be because I have a love of history and government. I became an intelligence analyst for the Navy Anti-Terrorist Alert Center. And this is in the 1980s, and terrorism is starting to become an issue for national security reasons for this country.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly at the time, Lebanon and Libya were sore spots for the United States. We had troops in Lebanon back in the 1980s,
mm-hmm.
With the Marines. And with Libya, we had Muammar Gaddafi, and he was involved in some random terrorist acts that took place against civilians, but also ended up killing some Navy people in Germany. So for this reason, there was some good forethought put into it that we need to have a Navy Intelligence Alert Center that sends out intel assessments to our ships stationed worldwide and any other Department of Naval assets. So, for example, if a ship is pulling into Karachi, Pakistan, the commander of that ship needs to know, what is my terrorist a threat? Do I let the sailors go out on leave or not, you know, when we're in port? Those kind of things. So that was my job, and I served for a year on a watch team. We had a 24/7, you know, we were up and running 24/7. So I served on a watch team, night shifts, day shifts, whereby we were always getting reports in, you know, in a real-time manner, and then would write up those reports for the team, the next team, and then, you know, they would brief, if it was a day team that we were briefing, they would brief the admiral about what our, you know, security risks were around the world with respect to terrorism. So it was a very interesting job because we always would get threat assessments in from the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, from State Department, from USAID, and then put all that information together and assess that information, and after evaluating it, determining what threat exists to Department of Naval assets and what does not. Sometimes that was kind of difficult to tell. But you had to be very well versed with politics and history and present-day government, you know, world politics, in a sense. You had to be very well versed about that because if you were on a watch team, you were looking everywhere to see, you know, what threats might exist so you could report that to the next team. So that fit in really well for me because of my interest in history and government politics.
Who was feeding the information to the watch team?
It would be, the sources were the State Department, CIA, the Pentagon, USAID, and all this information is coming from sources from around the world.
Okay, so like they would have people on the ground,
yes,
in places
it would be called what's called human intelligence sources, and they'd have SIGINT, which would be signal intelligence sources, and you're pooling all this information together and you're trying to figure out, is there a threat or is there not? Mm-hmm. And you'd have to know, for example, you know, we at the time, the Philippines had a internal insurgency afoot, and we had to, just to give you an example, we'd have to keep abreast. Well, what's their ideology? What's their latest movement? Who are they recruiting? You know, what kind of people are they recruiting? To see, okay, all right, they're a pimple here, but you know, they're not really going to be a problem. Or this movement is growing; they seem to be gathering more strength in the countryside, and this may become a threat to the Filipino government. And do they have anti-U.S. interest? Do they have a history of anti-U.S. interests? Or is it strictly their ideology? Or do you have any information that shows that they're receiving weaponry and maybe they're interested in branching out and starting to target U.S. assets? Those are the kind of things I'm talking about that we had to evaluate and make a determination. Is this a real threat or is it not? If we couldn't determine if it was a real threat, we would still put out the information. Here's what we know, but we don't know if this is a threat directly or not to Department of Naval Assets. So you need to be aware that there is this activity taking place, you know, and then you'd have to, the commander would have to make a decision on his own or her own what they're going to do about it. So what I'm saying is that intelligence can be vague. And we've learned that through Iraq. So you do the best you can with what you have.
I do think it's particularly interesting to look back on the time that you did this in comparison to a lot of what we're going through now, mm-hmm. because I think the U.S. public, through various, you know, media, I think increased media and internet and all that, mm-hmm. we have a better understanding, better meaning, probably more vague, but at least we have this understanding that there are these intel gathering organizations, mm-hmm. and that there are people on the ground and organizations, mm-hmm. you know, actual offices like this, where before I think maybe we were aware that it happened but didn't have an understanding, mm-hmm. of what that meant.
Or it must be, you know, the God's truth because it's the intelligence community.
Right.
But I can tell you that the intelligence community, there's a variety of opinions about how to assess a situation. There's a variety of way to get information. You have to ferret out what's bogus versus what you think is real. And over time, you can learn how to do that. It's just by doing it, you start to learn this instinctively, you know, besides gathering the facts, you know, you start to pick up on, I think this is a valid threat or not. And I'll give you an example. When Colin Powell went before the United Nations back in 2002, because we were considering going to war in Iraq,
right.
And he made the pitch that he did, I thought, this is not enough, in my opinion, to go to war in Iraq. There's not enough substantive information, and there's not enough validity to go to war. And I was, for that very reason, I was opposed to Iraq and attacking Iraq from day one. It wasn't that I ultimately came to that conclusion. I was very opposed to day one because I thought, as excellent as Colin Powell is in understanding situations, he did not present the case to me that the United States of America was under imminent threat. Mm-hmm. The administration tried to make it seem like it was under imminent threat, but there was no proof that it was. There was really, underlying it all, there was no proof that it was. What they had is information of conversations that were taking place amongst people that were anti-American that talked about targeting the United States. But that's all they had was conversation. And I don't know how you can piece together that's warrants that we go over and bomb a country when there's just conversation and there's no action and there was no verifiable information that Saddam Hussein was linked to al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. So now Afghanistan, I felt differently about because the Taliban harbored al-Qaeda. We had that ironclad information and that was justification enough to me, intelligence-wise, to use that and to use that as a pretext to go in and attack Afghanistan, but not for Iraq. Mm-hmm. So my intelligence background was very helpful to me in me making up my mind at a very early point in time that this was not the right war to go into. And I think because the American people did not understand the intelligence community, they were led to believe, and the intelligence community had to salute and fall in line with what the president wanted, because it's the executive branch and he oversees the executive branch, but you really couldn't have people come out and say, you know what, this guy's not telling the truth, or he cherry-picked information, and we really don't know for sure if Saddam Hussein is a direct threat to the United States or not.
That's a very good example.
So, just trying to point that out.
Well, it also feeds into this idea of we don't know how to interpret the information that we get now.
And that very easily can happen. Very easily can happen. And we need to acknowledge that, even though these are the intelligence communities and they're supposed to be, to know what's going on. It's not that they don't. Mm-hmm. But this is not like, you know, as with any other institution, there's no guarantee, or that you are immune from making mistakes.
Right. What would be some examples of situations that you were in whenever you were part of the intelligence analyzation team that maybe were vague or hard decisions for you to make?
Okay. Let me just say this, that once I served on the watch team for a year, then I rotated into a full-time analyst position for Africa. So that included North Africa, which would have been Egypt and Libya, Tunisia, Morocco. The more southern portion of Africa did not bode for any type of terrorist activity, with the exception of Kenya, which we had a naval port in Mombasa. So there was activity that we would see that was questionable. It showed some North African links into Kenya, and did that pose a potential threat to our port in Mombasa? And we never confirmed that it did, but we were always a suspect.
Were you stationed in D.C. still at
this? Yes, okay. I was. I was active duty for 4 years, and my active duty time was entirely in D.C., which was great. I loved it. I lived in the city, had a wonderful time, got to experience the city in every aspect that, you know, in a good way that I could do. Trying to think of a situation where your question is where we were suspect. Mombasa would be a good example, the port of Mombasa. We just weren't always sure. There was just seemed to be activity, but it never seemed to be large enough for us to conclude that there's a high level of threat against our port there. We would always say perhaps there's a low to mid-level threat. And you might be able to say, well, how can you differentiate between low, mid, and high? And all I can say is it really depends on your sources. Meaning, state, DIA, CIA, your human intelligence sources. Do you have enough information there to really make you believe there's a high-level threat? Mm-hmm. Or are you getting reports here and there, yeah, there's some activity, but you know, there's been no example of targeting before of U.S. assets or naval assets. There's some groups that are talking about it, or you've got a group that's organized, but there's just no history of attacking U.S. interests and U.S. naval interests, and there's just not enough there to put in a hook to think, okay, they're definitely going to attack you to make it high level. You see what I'm saying?
I do.
That was vague, you wouldn't make it a high-level threat.
Right.
So, but I will say, in the 1980s, after Libya was behind, there was a discotheque bombing in Germany, and there were some Navy soldiers that were killed. Something else happened, but then we eventually went in and attacked Libya, and we went in and tried to kill Gaddafi. This is in Tripoli, where we had this, where the U.S. Navy went in and attacked because the aircraft came off of ships, and then they went in and attacked Tripoli. They bombed the U.S. embassy accidentally, and they almost killed Gaddafi. In fact, I think his wife and his son was killed in this attack. Again, this is in the 1980s, mm-hmm. And I got all the after battle reports. So, for example, I would see. In the daytime, I could see what was bombed and what was not through photographs. I don't know how they do it now. I'm sure it's more high tech than that. But that's what, you know, it was an after action report. Here's what took place. And so we got all of that information. Also, I remember that there was a Pan Am flight that was hijacked. This is in relation to Lebanon, that was hijacked, and there were four Navy sailors on that, and one was shot and killed and thrown out on the tarmac in Beirut. And this is in 1983, 84. And I got the pictures back, even though this is in the Middle East, but I remember we got the pictures back of this Navy sailor who had been killed, Robert Steedham, I believe was his name. And, you know, that's something that the American public wouldn't have been shown. Right. So that was hard to see.
Do you think they would show it now?
No. No, I do not. It was a pretty brutal picture. The guy was shot in the head.
Oh,
so, yeah. And his body was dumped out on the tarmac. So that was pretty interesting. And then I would write reports. I would brief naval attachés who were going to be stationed in Africa, and I'd give them a briefing about what are the terrorist threat assessments for the country that they're going to be assigned. We'd have meetings over at the State Department and the CIA, so I got to see these people and see what, you know, how the different agencies operate. I was really impressed with the CIA. They were very, very sharp people, very sharp. But all the different agencies, CIA and State and the Pentagon, they're all very different organizations. They have very different views from one another, and it was interesting to see that.
What would be an example of that?
Well, State was more focused on diplomacy and talk and behind the scenes, and the Pentagon was more, you know, the military can take care of this, and you know, there's just a bunch of eggheads at the State Department, and they just want to sit down and negotiate, where not everything is negotiable. So the CIA was always kind of hard to put my finger on exactly where they were, but they were very, very sharp people, very sharp people. I do remember after getting out of the Navy, after off of active duty, I thought of applying to the CIA, but I really came to the conclusion I wouldn't know who I could ever trust completely, and I didn't think I wanted to be in that kind of work environment. But having said that, I never worked there, so I don't know truly what that work environment was like. And I think the CIA does provide intelligence is a valuable tool in helping to determine policy. Just got to make sure the right people are there with the right values. You know, anybody wanting to go be a James Bond should not join the CIA. So, one other thing I want to mention about, which I think is interesting, having served in naval intelligence, when I was trained for my watch duty job, I was trained by Jonathan J. Pollard, and he ended up spying for Israel. And he was actually stealing secrets out of our office unit and selling them to the Israeli intelligence Mossad. And he was caught for it. And like I said, he was working right out of our office. Our commander at the time was suspicious of information that was missing and began to think, I think it's Jay. And so they put surveillance cameras in the office and nobody knew about it. And they picked up on Jay taking top secret, you know, information out, and then he would go somewhere in D.C. and sell that information to the Israeli Mossad. So I was actually, and then he's still in jail. I mean, they've been asked, I think you have those, some of those who are great friends of Israel have asked for Jay to be, his lifelong sentence to be commuted, but it never has been. President Clinton was asked him, and he said no. But anyway, I worked with Jay for several years, so it was interesting to work with someone who's actually spying for a friend. You know, Israel's a friend, and they're spying for a friend, but yet doing something that was highly illegal and considered treasonous to the country, because this was information that the American government did not want to share with Israel. And yet Israel thought we were hiding information, the American government's hiding information from them that they felt would be value to their national security interest, and therefore were paying someone to be a mole, like Jay, to furnish them with the information. It was a big brouhaha at the time. And he was actually a friend of mine, came to my wedding down party, which that's when you're promoted, you have a wedding down party, wetting down. And I remember introducing him to my parents. So that was interesting. But I loved my 4 years in Washington. And I got to meet some great people. Ambassador Bruce Langen, who was the chargé d'affaires in Tehran when Iranian extremists captured our embassy at the time and held the hostages for 440 something days. He was an excellent man to work with. I remember meeting Art Buchwald, who was a former columnist, I believe, for the Washington Post. I had to go pick him up at the airport. He was very funny to talk to. And I remember watching Petra Green. She came to speak at the National Defense University, and she was ahead of the Green Party at the time. They really tried to bring in diverse thinkers when I was at the National Defense University to expose you to all kinds of different thought. And that was a good thing. So, and then meeting Jack Jacobs. And so it was kind of a heady time for me. And I got out because I didn't plan on staying after 4 years. I just thought I want to do 4 years and move on, and I stuck with that plan. So I got out.
When, just moving back a little bit, whenever you were moved from watch to over kind of Africa, how did that happen? Did you just get, was that just open and they assigned you there?
Yeah, typically you served on the watch team for a year. It was very hard to serve on a watch team because you always worked day shifts and night shifts. For example, you'd have 3 days on, then a day and a half off, and then you'd have to switch to a night shift. And then you'd switch from a night shift to a day shift. I mean, it was just, it's really hard on you. So after a year, that analyst position became open, and I asked for it, and I was given that assignment. So, and I was glad to have it. I was glad to have a day job again.
Understandably.
Yeah.
I think that was the curiosity, was it was just by default that it became open, or is that something that you had interest in before?
It was just by default it became open. And I was glad to have it. I wanted Africa. So, and I was glad to have it. I mean, I was just, what I'm saying is, versus any other area of the world, I really wanted Africa because I wanted to learn more about Africa.
So it was a desire to learn instead of being familiar with it beforehand.
Yeah,
is that
exactly?
It's interesting.
And I've never been to Africa, and I plan on going to Africa, but I just thought I need to. This is an area of the world I want to learn more about.
That was my next question.
I did.
If you had been there?
No. No, I had not been there. I planned to go there at some point, but I haven't been there.
I'm sure you would have a different perspective of the country other than most tourists going to visit.
Well, I would be mindful of, probably so, I guess, because although I would think anybody traveling to Africa who's halfway paying attention would know that there's some perhaps added risk involved, particularly perhaps in North Africa.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So you were in D.C. for 4 years.
Yes.
And what happened after that?
Well, I came back to Kentucky. There was a political campaign. A friend of the family's was running for lieutenant governor, and he had designs to run for governor at some point. But anyway, I got involved in his lieutenant governor campaign and worked on that, Burton Jones, and worked on that for a couple of months. And then I packed my car and headed west to California because that's what I'd always wanted to do, was to go live in California for a long time. So I packed my car and didn't have a job or anything and went out and traveled up and down the coast and landed. I decided I liked Santa Barbara the best. So I plunked myself down and then applied for a job in radio and got it. And did that for a year and a half. I worked in Monterey and in Santa Barbara. I was really living like a gypsy. I mean, I had a futon and a TV and that's about it. But this is the 20s, so that's when you should do these things. And then I joined the military reserves in Santa Barbara, the naval reserves in Santa Barbara, and they were a military sea lift unit. And they were assigned to the military sea lift command out of Long Beach, California, the port of Long Beach. So during the first Persian Gulf War in the early 90s, my unit was activated for several weeks, and I went down to Long Beach and worked with the Teamsters, longshoremen who are Teamsters, rough group, and oversaw cargo ships being loaded for the Middle East, tanks, things like that, even though those are Army, but it's Navy because these are cargo ships. So we had to oversee our job. And I mean, I remember going down in the cargo ships and making sure these tanks are, you know, the longshoremen had securely fastened these tanks, because you're traveling, you know, an ocean overseas, and you don't want your equipment to be damaged, your munitions. And I kept thinking to myself, how did I get here? But, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm here, so I, you know, I guess I have to do this, and I'm going to do it as well as I can. And so I did that for 2 years. And met some neat people there, and I did get to go on active duty for 3 weeks in Japan, 2 weeks in Okinawa, and then I took a week of just touring Japan. I wanted to go to Japan, and so this was a way to get to do it. And I found Japan fascinating, and this is really at the height of Japan's economic heyday. So this is the late 1980s, and Japan was considered the, at that time, you know, the one of the superpowers. And they still are, but not like, I think they're the fourth largest economy in the world, but they're not, I think it's the fourth, either second, third, or fourth. But they don't have that eminence like they had in the late 1980s, where Japan was considered gold with anything economically. And that was really neat to see Japan and to see the, I don't know, to experience the culture and see, a lot of Japan was destroyed during World War II, and you could tell because there were so many new buildings, but I had a chance to go to Kyoto where they had Shinto shrines and Buddhist temples that had been preserved and had not been attacked during World War II. And I remember, I'll mention this quickly, I remember this was in March, and there were these beautiful Japanese cherry blossoms, and there was this path along this river called the Path of Philosophy, so everything in Eastern culture has a philosophical or, I don't know, a sense of innerness about oneself. And so I remember walking along the Path of Philosophy, and the Japanese cherry trees are all in bloom, and I thought, wow, I'm really glad to be here. And so the Navy was enabled me to be there. I guess I could have gone on my own, saved my money, but this was the reason I got to go, was through the Navy. And I love travel, so the Navy sort of facilitated that for me.
Well, that's part of the reason why you went into the Navy.
I did.
Was to be able to do things like
yes.
that. So mm-hmm, that makes mm-hmm, a huge difference. Mm-hmm. When you were working in California and you were
yep.
loading, kind of making sure that all these boats were being
yep.
loaded right and working with all these Teamsters, were there a lot of women that were
no.
doing that?
Very few. Very, very few.
How did that play into things?
Well, I think it's like what we talked about before. You know, I had to kind of probably prove myself first that I could, you know, I was capable and I could do the job. But once it was observed that I could, you know, it didn't seem like it was a big deal after that. But I was always keenly aware that I was always one of the very few women. And today, in 2009, women make up about 14 to 15% of the military. And so I don't, you know, it probably was a smaller percentage when I was in, but not that much smaller.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt you're blazing trails, and you are... I mean, I always was conscious of the fact that I'm a woman and I need to do this well because I'm having an impact on what men think about women. And I wanted to leave a good impression. So I always tried to be professional, have fun, but be professional. And I mean, I guess that's probably what I can say. Just be professional, but have some fun along the way too. There's a great Navy saying. I think it's great, and it's stuck with me to this day. And the saying is, if you're not having fun, you're not just doing it right. You're not doing it right. So I always think about that because I think there's real truth to that. You should have some fun in what you do. There are some jobs that's hard to do, but there's plenty of jobs where you can enjoy what you do.
I think that is good
mm-hmm.
advice to live by too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you got to go to Japan,
mm-hmm.
and you were still living in California at that
mm-hmm.
point.
Mm-hmm.
So what, did you stick around there for a few more years?
I stayed in California for 3 years, and then I decided I wanted to go to law school.
Mm-hmm.
And the best way for me to go to law school was to come back to Kentucky and live at home and go to school. So that way I wouldn't go deeply into debt. Now, that's not really what I wanted to do. I really wanted to go to law school in California, and I applied to several schools like UCLA and UC Hastings, and I didn't get in. I think I was under the illusion, because of my background, I might not have a problem getting in. Well, I did. My LSATs were not the best, and I was a three-point student in college, so, you know, for some of those law schools, that wasn't good enough. So anyway, came back to Kentucky, lived at home, went to Chase Law School at Northern Kentucky University, and got a terrific education. I would say it was probably the best formal education I've ever had was law school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I wanted to go to law school because, again, of my interest in history and government and politics, and I knew law fit into that very well. And I I think I was right, because I think the education just, it just kind of brought some of those areas together. It tied those areas more together for me. Mm-hmm. And I could see how more they interrelate. So I did that. And then I went into state government in 1994 and did that until 2004. And then a new administration came in, and I was offered a job in Louisville with a nonprofit as the CEO, and I took that and did that, and then came back to state government once the new administration was elected, and here I am in this job.
What was the nonprofit?
Planned Parenthood.
Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. Great. Mm-hmm. Was that kind of a shift? I mean,
yes. Well, in some ways it was, in some ways it wasn't. I mean, I've always had an interest in women's issues, so it was a shift because it was not state government. It was a nonprofit, and I had never worked for a nonprofit before. So that was some adjustment. And I really realized the nonprofit world's a very hard world to be in. There's always that constant struggle for money. And when I went into that organization, there were some problems, and it needed some big changes. So I hit the ground running with putting out 10 fires at once. And but the mission was right on, and that was to serve women in all areas of reproductive health. So,
right. Wow. So, but you stayed 4 years. Were you ready to come back, or were you?
Well, no. Actually, I did Planned Parenthood for a year, and then I have a daughter who's 11 at this time, and 2009. But I was in my mid-40s, and I came to the conclusion: I have all these years in state government. I probably should get back in. And I felt that the governor at the time was not going to be reelected, and so my chances would be fairly decent with me getting in with a new governor coming in. And I took a little bit of the roll of the dice and got back into state government, and it wasn't particularly a job I cared for, but it's just, I kind of thought, I'm trying to think long term. Mm-hmm. And then a new governor was elected, and so I you know, the trouble paid off, I suppose. And you know, and now I am in this job, so, and adding to my years in government. And I've always liked working in government. I mean, just ever since I was a little girl, I've always liked politics and history. I don't know where that comes from, but it comes from something. And my family too, you know, that's their area of interest and the areas they've worked in as well. So my mother's in education, and her family was also involved in politics. So I guess I got it early on in my life. And so I've really never had a yen to do anything outside of government. I mean, the nonprofit fit into my idea of serving community, but I like public service. Now, I'm not saying it doesn't have frustrations, and you're not going to get rich, but that's not my goal. So
yeah.
I just don't think I think I was meant for the public sector, not the private sector. I like the idea of giving back to your community, to your country, and it's not like, you know, I'm a zealot about that, but I think it's important that, you know, your life should be important to you, but it's just not about you. You're part of a collective. You are a part of a society. And if we're all so into ourselves and we don't think about other people, we'd be a worse off society versus, you know, we need to take time to care and nurture mm-hmm. our lives, you know, not only our own lives, but our community around us. And I think being a good person is important.
I agree.
Having high standards and trying to live well, but trying to live right. And I don't mean that in a sense that black and white, you know, but I think just trying to be a decent person, because I think that's important.
I think that's a good thing to work towards too, and it fits in with what you've done with your life. From the time that you left the Navy Reserves when you were in California, it sounds like, up until when you started with the KDBA,
mm-hmm.
were you active at all in military anything during that time period?
Well, good question. When I came back here and was in law school, I joined a unit in Lexington and then moved to a unit in Louisville, because the Louisville unit was more intel oriented. that dealt with monitoring submarine activity around Latin America. Now, it's not like that was extremely busy, but that's what it was. So I did have that involvement, and then I got out of the military in 1994, and between 1994 and 2009, until I joined KDVA, I didn't have any involvement with the military. And all of my friends, none of them were in the military. I don't have a, as we talked about, I don't have a background with my family in the military. So I really, you know, and I'm a fairly, on the political spectrum, I'm probably center left. And so I had many people who would say to me, how are you ever in the military? And I think what I want to say, and what I do say is, well, the military's not a monolith. Yes, by and large, it's conservative thinking, but it's also very diverse culturally. You have all kinds of people from all kinds of backgrounds. I mean, you really do. So I want to stress how culturally diverse the military is, and that the military needs all kinds of thinking. You know, you need all kinds of thinkers. It may not be popular, but that's what you need. So I'm not very good about saluting and shutting up. There are times when I know when to do it, but on the other hand, I think it's important to ask the right questions without appearing as if you are trying to undermine the institution. My goal is to make the institution better. So the way to do it is to ask the critical questions. How can you improve upon what you're doing? So, and just because, you know, you're engaged in conflict, it doesn't always mean that it's the right conflict. I can support the troops, but it doesn't mean I necessarily always support the objectives of why we're there. But I always support the troops, always. And I'm always very appreciative of any veteran I meet and thank them for serving, because they are serving their country. And there are people who are asked to put their lives on the line, and that's tough. And some people don't make it. So there's real sacrifice involved, and I'm very mindful of the human element and the human experience of being in the military.
Well, you're very intimate with that right now, I think, in the position you're at with the mortality of serving.
Yes, very much so. It's painful. It's painful.
It seems to me, too, that you're asked a lot to meet the families of people who have recently lost.
We are. We have what's called a Kentucky Medal for Freedom, and we will give those to family members who have had a son or daughter killed in action in armed conflict, and it's pretty tough. I mean, that's why, you know, you look into the face and you're putting the medal on this person, and their faces are crestfallen, and you can't help but feel the very real consequences of war. And that's why I think when we put young people in harm's way, we better make darn sure. It's not just about our national interests and projecting power. It's about, is there an imminent threat to this country? And so, you know, when you're sending young people to war, you need to be very mindful of, is this not just about politics or geopolitics or about you don't like a dictator. It's about a real threat to this country. And perhaps that's where I draw the line.
I mean,
death is a very real and serious matter. This is not about, you know, trying to prove yourself or seeing how tough you can be. It's the real deal. And so I'm very mindful of that. I'm not like, you know, it's hoorah, yay, let's go to war and let's kill all the bad guys. That's not how I think.
Right. I think you have a very well-rounded perspective just from being in intelligence and being on different ground levels and now being I don't want to say it's almost the after effect, but it kind of is, from being to the person who like dells out the intelligence to decide kind of how we act upon things, to now the person who deals with the effects of those actions, almost. So it seems like you've really come full circle through a straight path, almost.
Well, I'm very conscious of the decisions that are made, you know. But, you know, my military background was not, other than OCS, was not, you know, salute and shut up. I mean, I was in an environment where yes, you have to be respectful of the chain of command. That's not what's at issue here. But in the subject matter you're dealing with, you have to ask a lot of questions. And you get a variety of opinions, and you get real debate. Not everybody can look at the same set of facts and view it the same way. That's like being in law school as well. You know, I think that was, being an analyst was a good feeding ground for law school, because you're dealing with a lot of analysis.
Yeah.
Although I felt being in the intelligence community in the Navy was a lot more interesting to a large degree than law school. But nonetheless, law school was very good about even honing real critical thinking skills. And so that part of it was great. So actions have consequences. And I've lost a sibling, so I know what loss is about. So I know, not in the military, but I've lost a sibling, so I know what loss feels like.
How did you lose your sibling?
Well, I had a brother who suffered from depression and the consequences of that. So I also know the importance of mental health and soldiers who are coming back from serving, and how important to help reintegrate them into society, and that that's not necessarily an easy thing to do, and that there are really real mental health issues out there for people when they've served and been involved in trauma, been involved in, you know, battle and thinking about life and death every day. How do you just come back home and, you know, go to the supermarket and shop and watch some goofy TV on, you know, sitcom or reality show and think, where are our priorities here? You know, that takes some real adjustment. So probably all of that stuff for mental health and PTSD should have been around a long time ago for serving members of the military, and wasn't, because it was considered a stigma. Somehow showing vulnerabilities is considered an emotional weakness.
Mm-hmm. We've definitely come a lot of ground, and we have a lot of ground left to go with that.
Well, I think mental health is just taken more seriously. It's a very viable area of one's overall well-being.
But even culturally, we have a long way to go to really give that as much attention as it needs, I think.
But I think people are more open to it.
I agree.
People are more open to it, and what, and you know, are open to counseling and what the benefits can be to that, and that there's not, I'm not saying there's not stigma. I think there is more stigma in the military, because by and large there is a there can be and is a macho or this hyper masculinized view of how you're supposed to be. I think particularly as a young person, where you consider yourself invincible and you're physically very strong and the world is your oyster. So you think, but it's not always the way it works.
It's true.
I was looking for my water. Here it is.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to think back too on parts that we kind of skipped over. And one part is this idea that when you came back to Kentucky, how does a group in Louisville monitor submarine? I mean,
we get intel information.
So it's just basically
from
satellites.
Intel communities. Yeah. And I did my 2 weeks of active duty in D.C. Actually, in Suitland, Maryland, right outside of D.C. So we were attached to a unit out of D.C. that actually does that activity. So, but we would meet once a month, which is what you do. And then my 2 weeks active duty, I went and I remember working on a term paper, this long report. Excuse me, I don't remember what it was about because this was 15 years ago, but I remember writing this long threat assessment based on all the sources that I had in front of me. So it was like, honestly, like writing a term paper, you know, get the facts out and then you give it your best shot with what you think the analysis should be.
Mm-hmm. So when you finally did get out of the reserves, how was that emotionally? You'd been attached to
it. It was time to go. I just graduated from law school. I stayed a lot longer in the military than I ever thought I would. And it ended up being an enjoyable experience. I had no idea I'd like the military as much as I did. And it's not the salute and, you know, put on the uniform thing. It was more about the camaraderie, the sense of purpose, common goal, and people were purposeful. Plus, I met people from all over the country. And people who had most people I met were different thinkers or had a different philosophical bent than I did. So I was constantly challenged. I had to challenge my own way of thinking. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. In 1984, when I was on active duty, and I'm working for this intelligence unit, I was the only person that voted for Walter Mondale in my unit, and everybody else voted for Ronald Reagan. And so I really got razzed, big time for it, big time for it. Mm-hmm. But so the military was good in terms of challenge my way of thinking, my political views. And I had to stop and think. I'm like, okay, I need to think about some things some more. I think it made me a better thinker. It made me listen to another side that I was perhaps not as willing to listen to before.
I think that's a good way to look at that mm-hmm. as well. And that is kind of, I think, a stereotype, as you were talking about before, this conservatism. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's there. Most people in the military are conservative political thinkers. I was not, but, mm-hmm. and I got kind of, I guess because I was with an intel unit, maybe I could get away with it, but and it's not like I went around and, boasted about that. But, I developed good friendships with people, with the people with whom I worked, so we would talk politics. Mm-hmm. And so it would kind of come out how your views were. And but I really learned that, that I guess I was not a monolithic thinker, that I'm not all left, and that sometimes I'm center, and that I can listen to, a reasonable point of view that may be more conservative than mine. I really came to the conclusion that I don't like the extremes. Mm-hmm. Because I think there's so much emotion involved in debate that there's not the time to stop and look at and take a step back and use your head and look at the facts. Mm-hmm. But then once again, the way you look at a certain set of facts and the way I look at a certain set of facts could be very different. So.
Well, exactly. And that's...
It's all about persuasion and about, making your points. Why you think it is the way it is. So.
Well, that's been your training with, your interest in your training with history, politics, mm-hmm. law, mm-hmm. and the things that you did while mm-hmm. you were in the active Navy. Mm-hmm.
It all kind of fits. Mm-hmm. It all kind of fits.
Very well. So what happens if your daughter gets older and wants to join the military? How do you feel?
I guess it depends on where we are with our military and if we're involved in armed conflict. In the Navy today, women can serve on ships, they fly aircraft, and they now just opened up for women to serve on submarines. I'd say it's her decision. I would be nervous. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I wouldn't be. And because she's my only child, would I encourage her to do something else? I'm selfish in that regard. Yeah, I probably would. But if she, it's not because it's not being patriotic. It's just, my flesh and it's my daughter. I don't want to, you never want to think about losing your child. And if you join the military, there is always that chance, even for women today, there's always that chance. You might not come back. So that being a possibility, I would be like, geez, honey, really think about this. But if it's really, really what she wanted to do, even though I'd have, quite frankly, some strong feelings about it, I'd say, okay. I can't live my daughter's life. She has to live her own life.
How did your parents react whenever you told them that you were joining the
military? They thought it was great. They thought it was great. Nobody ever thought she's going to lose her life or anything like that. So nobody said, oh, honey, you really shouldn't do that. This is not for a woman to do. Or, we're afraid you might, something might happen to you. It was like, it was an adventure for them that I was doing it. I think there were extended members of my family who thought it wasn't the most feminine thing to do. But I'm like, they didn't express it, but I kind of got that feeling that this was unusual for a woman to do, and it must mean certain things. And so anyway, I did it anyway. But my parents were all, they loved it. They were envious. They didn't do it. So particularly my mother. But I think they were looking at it from an idealized point of view.
The travel and the adventure.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Yes. Maybe if I had been a son, maybe they would have viewed it differently.
Well, that's something that you just kind of mentioned, too, with looking at your daughter. There's so many more options for her, you know,
yes.
to be out there in the yes. middle of the thick of everything.
Yes.
What were the options available for you as a woman when you joined the military?
You couldn't serve on ships. I think you could serve on tenders, which are support ships for actual ships that are involved in combat-related activity. So I couldn't serve on a combatant, okay? I could serve on a non-combatant, and then you couldn't fly an airplane, and you couldn't serve on a submarine. So your opportunities for combat-related service was far and few between. But that's where you often get your promotions, is that you've served in combat. So that's a detriment for women. It's still not fair. It's still not completely equal. It's better than when I was there, but it's not completely equal. My theory is it's the best person for the job. If you can meet the physical standards, then it shouldn't matter. The physical and the mental standards, it does not matter. I don't care. You know, I'm not one of these people. Why is it better for a son to come home in a body bag than it is for your daughter? It's horrible, period.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know. I just think you want the best troops that you can get, mentally and physically. I'd rather fight with a woman who's 30 years old and tough mentally, and she has experience in combat, versus a 19-year-old kid who's male and who doesn't have a clue what to do. Or he's trying to be a tough guy and may make some stupid decisions because of it. So smart is just as important as the physical component, I think, when it comes to hand-to-hand combat. I don't diminish the physical, but I think you need the smart as well. And so why not take your best troops, period? And plus, a lot of today, a military conflict is, you know, high-tech. Mm-hmm. And women can play those roles just as well as a man.
Very good point. Did it bother you in the 80s when you were going through this that there were things that were off limits to
yeah,
you?
Yeah, sure. Or that were off limits to women. Actually, I got to do what I wanted to do, was serving the intelligence community. That's what I wanted to do. But yeah, did it bother me? Because it implies that women aren't good enough. Mm-hmm. They're not capable of it. And it's just with a wide, you know, brush stroke that all women are, can't drive a ship, and because they may not have the same physical muscularity, that somehow they can't fly an airplane as well as a man, which is wrong. You know, that's high tech. You don't need to be 6'2", and, you know, be a brawny person and to fly an airplane.
Right.
You need smarts, and you need someone who's, you know, science and scientifically oriented, and plenty of women can do that. So.
And that's all very interesting, too. Just to think about. It's also this concept, I think, of regardless of your military background, you've come a long way as a person in politics, in state government. There's a lot of different roles that you've played to be in this position.
I would say that's probably true.
Yeah. Do you ever just kind of think about that and, gosh, how did I even get here?
I guess sometimes I do. I mean, I feel like I am where I should be. I mean, I actually could be in a lot of places. I feel mm-hmm. like I'm a person who can do a lot of different things.
I would agree.
So I'm not saying that this is... I mean, am I cut out for this? Yes. Do I like doing this? Yes. Is it a culmination of some things? Absolutely. But I feel like I can do a lot of different things. I mean, not only here, I can, you know, I'd love to work in Washington again at some point. But I feel very grateful that I have this opportunity. Very grateful, particularly because of the people that I work with and the veterans. I think the veterans are good people, by and large, very good people. So.
I think that's interesting. I hope your daughter sees the things you've done too. And one of these days, after she's going, "Oh, Mom."
I know. I've heard it all. What else is new? And I love to travel, and she's such a homebody. I mean, she loves to stay at home, and she's only 11 and one kid, but she's traveled a lot with me.
Yeah.
But she likes to She likes to stay home, so. But I think for her, the future is wide open, and she can be whatever she wants to be. It's just a matter of what she chooses to be. So, and I will say this, that I do think it takes a special kind of woman to be in the military. It's not one who's faint of heart. But I would also say that's true for men, too.
Right.
You know, you have to have a certain inner toughness about you to do it, because you go through a lot.
I'm trying to imagine what my reaction would be if somebody handed me a toilet or handed me a toothbrush and said, go clean the urinals. I mean, what?
It's disgusting. But I thought, I know this is just a, this is a game. I'll play this game. No problem. I'll do it. And I'm not a game player. I don't like that. I don't have any hidden agendas. I'm not out, you know. I want to do well, but I want to do well in a way that also meets my values. And my values are that, you know, you work hard, but you play smart, but you don't hurt people along the way.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people are pretty good at survival. You do what you have to do sometimes to get through.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not the worst thing in the world I've ever done. So, but it makes for a funny story.
It does.
It makes for a funny story, because it just goes to show you that, you know, you're going to have to grovel here. All right, I'll grovel. I'm not used to it, but I'll do it.
I think it's a good point. I think it probably takes people a lot longer to figure that out sometimes. There are things you just have to get through to get where you want to go.
I think, too, because I grew up pretty privileged and had a lot of opportunities and, you know, pretty carefree and not highly structured or organized family background. Probably a great recipe for failure in the military,
yeah,
particularly early on. But I just had this certain inner voice that said, you stick with it. You need to see if you can do this. I just, you know, it was important to me to get through it, to do it.
I think that your experience is a good analogy for how the military can be helpful for a lot of different people. You know, I think a lot of the stories that we get are really battle-oriented. They're really, they're more this kind of glory of combat, mm-hmm. and the, you know, the medals people have won and the recognition.
I'm not saying that's not important.
That's not my emphasis. Well, and that's not what I'm not saying it's not important, but what I'm saying is there's another side to this, and there's another way that the military can be beneficial for people as well. I mean, besides just saying, well, you know, I was fortunate enough to come back from combat and have the story, and this is what people want to hear. I think there's more to it by saying, this is how it played a role in my life, and this is how it helped me get to where I am today. And I think that story is just as important on many different levels as the one we hear more often.
Well, I will say, too, when I wore the uniform, I mean, I felt like, you know, I felt like I was doing something. I felt like I was a part of something that was something bigger than me. And that's not to say that I always, you know, agree with every decision that's made,
mm-hmm.
every time by the military.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I'm disloyal.
Yeah.
It just means that I think.
Yeah.
I'm thinking. And I think there's a lot of gray matter in this life, and that really few things are black and white. But I will unequivocally say, I will always be supportive of a veteran. Always be supportive of a veteran. And
you're in the right position then.
Yeah, yeah. I just think that's the right thing to do.
Awesome. Well, I think we've done an hour.
Okay, did we do an hour?
We did.
Great.
So I'm gonna.